Living with diabetes is exhausting, both for our bodies and minds. It's not surprising that many diabetics struggle with the mental health side of this disease, including burnout and diabetes distress. We at the Diacast want to remind anyone who is struggling that you deserve all the help and support in the world. If you're struggling, please go to diacast.com/resources for a list of resources and links, diabetes support groups, ways to find therapists in your area who specialize in diabetes, and crisis lines. Diabetes is hard, and sometimes we all need a hand.
Hello, and welcome to the Diacast. Today, we are here to talk about the different types of diabetes, because there are more than just type 1 and type 2, and there are a ton of bits of misinformation about all of them out there in the world. Today's goal will be to provide a high-level understanding of what makes different types of diabetes different, including management and physiological reasons. This being the Diacast, of course, odds are we are going to get stuck in the weeds a little bit more than we should because Amy apparently is incapable of paring down research, but we're going to give this a shot anyway. So welcome, Amy. Good evening. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good. I apologize for nothing. Good. Ever.
As you shouldn't. I think our listeners enjoy the depth of knowledge we give them, plus all the homework and the links on the descriptions. Yeah. So we'll be okay.
I'm just going to apologize in advance. I tried again. We're trying to not horribly mispronounce things. We're going to muck it up because I was informed by a couple of the doctors in my life. They have classes in this stuff. I'm an engineer.
I am also in a field of engineering, and pronouncing things is not my forte.
Yeah, if it's not about dirt, I am not your person. But, okay, so I guess before we get going, Liz, what's your BG right now?
That is a good question. I am currently at 106 mg/dL, which is 5.9 millimoles.
Hell yeah.
How about you?
I am 127 mg/dL, which is 7.0 millimole. With, as per usual for my Diacast episodes, a massive delta.
So, at least this delta is going in the upward direction and not the downward one like the last time we chatted.
Oh, God. This is my life. I am a hot mess. But that's okay. So
it is.
We've all been, as you know, as people with diabetes, we've all been in a place where somebody finds out that you have diabetes and asks if it's the bad kind, which is obviously an incredibly ignorant question. And often we're just not comfortable enough in our own knowledge to aggressively educate people as to why they're wrong, why there isn't a good or a bad kind of diabetes. So as Liz mentioned, kind of our goal today is to help clear up some of those common misconceptions and the misperceptions and confusion about what the heck diabetes actually is and how it works and what the differences are. In the past, you've heard us talk about insulin-resistant and insulin-deficient diabetes. And I am a big fan of this vernacular because it helps us remove some of the stigmas that are often associated with type 2 diabetes. But also because at the end of the day, you can have, you can be primarily insulin deficient, but also have insulin resistance. And you can be primarily insulin resistant, which is more of a metabolic thing, but also have insulin deficiency. So the real difference between these most common types of diabetes, that's the type 1 and type 2 diabetes, is the autoimmune response versus the metabolic disorder. And that's just at the heart of the diagnosis. And this is just for the type 1 and type 2. We're going to get into the type 3 subset and LADA here shortly.
Insulin deficient and insulin resistant, the story of our lives, both our lives, I think.
God bless modern medicine.
Absolutely. So Type 1 diabetes is what we like to refer to here as insulin deficient diabetes, where the insulin producing cells in the pancreas, known as beta cells, are destroyed. Typically, type 1 diabetes can be diagnosed by testing for antibodies that are associated with autoimmune destruction of the beta cells. Immune-mediated diabetes commonly occurs in childhood and adolescence, but it can occur at any age, even the 8th and 9th decades of life, which is a big surprise for quite a few people that come into our support spaces. Markers of immune destruction of the beta cell include islet cell antibodies, autoantibodies to insulin, autoantibodies to glutamic acid and decarboxylase. Yeah, I did it. And autoantibodies to tyrosine phosphatases. Phosphatases. Yes, I did it again.
Yeah.
IA2 and IA2B. Typically, one or more of these antibodies, which we're going to start referring to as antibodies because it's fewer syllables and we're lazy, are present in 85 to 90% of type 1s at the time of diagnosis. There is research that suggests antibody positive type 1 has strong associations with a gene called HLA, human leukocyte antigen, and can either be predisposing or protective. With all that said, you can diagnose type 1 diabetes based off an elevated glucose, low plasma C-peptide levels. C-peptide tests are used as a measure of how much insulin is being produced, and a low C-pep suggests beta cell destruction, or also known as insulin deficiency, while a high C-pep is suggested of insulin resistance. At the end of the day, the C-pep is probably the most useful test when diagnosing diabetes, and it's a measure of insulin secretion and can rapidly tell you how the diabetes should be treated moving forward.
So just... because I actually, it's so islet cell autoantibodies, so that's ICAs.
Ah.
And then the glutamic acid decarboxylase is the GAD65 autoantibody that you often hear about. Just, you know, for those who have been tested for antibodies. So in antibody positive type 1s, which we are now just going to refer to as type 1, the rate of beta cell destruction is actually very variable. In some individuals, it's very rapid, namely in infants and children. The younger you are, the more likely you are to have rapid beta cell destruction, whereas adults tend to have slower beta cell destruction. And that period of time where your beta cells are still in existence and producing some insulin, but they're slowly dying. That's what we refer to as the honeymoon phase. Some patients, again, particularly children and adolescents, may present with diabetic ketoacidosis, DKA, as the first manifestation of the disease. Well, others have modest fasting hyperglycemia that can rapidly change to severe hyperglycemia or DKA in the presence of infection or other stressors. So some adults may retain residual beta cell function sufficient to prevent DKA for many years. So this prolonged honeymoon phase with the presence of the autoantibodies is known as latent autoimmune diabetes in adults, or LADA, sometimes known, also referred to as type 1.5 diabetes. So people with LADA will eventually become insulin dependent as their beta cells are destroyed, and they experience a significant reduction in insulin secretion. And so, again, that insulin secretion can be measured using C-peptide tests, where low or undetectable levels of plasma C-pep indicate a loss of insulin production. So for some period of time, often years, people with LADA may be able to manage their diabetes using lifestyle and oral meds, which gradually have to be adjusted and increased until they are ultimately fully insulin dependent. LADA generally makes up, you know, 10 to 12% of adult type 1 diabetes diagnoses. So, kind of as an interesting aside, Islet beta cell autoimmunity can precede the onset of LADA by several years. So this has actually been observed in nearly two-thirds of patients with LADA in a prospective study, and sustained autoimmunity as the first insult. So that's an increase of, or a following increase of insulin resistance that causes overt hyperglycemia, and then the diagnosis of autoantibody positive type 1. So basically, you have patients with an elevated blood glucose with insulin resistance similar to type 2 diabetes, even when you correct for things like, you know, BMI and, you know, other factors that may be an indicator of insulin resistance. And so there's often an initial misdiagnosis of type 2 diabetes in adults with LADA. And unlike a straight up type 1 diagnosis, the pathophysiology of LADA involves both autoimmunity and a metabolic derangement of insulin resistance. So you have this combination of insulin deficiency with insulin resistance. And so it is kind of, it's an abnormal presentation of diabetes. So that's where kind of the type 1.5 label comes from.
Almost type 1, but not quite. You know, autoimmune destruction of beta cells has multiple genetic predispositions and is also believed to be related to environmental factors that are still poorly defined. Although patients are rarely obese when they present with type 1, the presence of obesity is not incompatible with the diagnosis. To make it even more fun, antibody-positive type 1s are also prone to other autoimmune disorders, such as Graves' disease, Hashimoto's thyroiditis, Addison's disease, vitiligo, and pernicious anemia. As we've discussed, when diagnosing type 1 diabetes, doctors are often looking for low C-peptide levels, indicating diminished insulin secretion, for in addition to the presence of antibodies, indicating the autoimmune process and associated with beta cell destruction. In addition to low C-peptide levels, indicative of insulin deficiency and beta cell destruction. In some cases, no evidence of autoimmunity is present, but low C-peptide levels show insulin deficiency. Idiopathic diabetes, aka autoantibody negative, is known as type 1B, makes up approximately 6.6% of known diabetics. Type 1B has no evidence of autoimmunity, generally identified by the presence of some or all of the antibodies discussed a second ago, and lacks immunological evidence for beta cell autoimmunity. It also does not appear to be associated with HLA genes, which are typically present in antibody positive type 1s.
And so
we've chatted with a couple type 1Bs,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, well, so I am type 1B, and both of my sisters are. We are all antibody negative. And Gary Hall Jr. was type 1B. He's type 1B. So, I mean, it is, there's actually some studies. It's a little unclear because there appears to be a little bit of testing bias. But somewhere between, yeah, about, you know, 6.5 to 12% of type 1s are antibody negative. Now, there is some interesting research. Sorry, this is a tangent. And I cut this out of our show notes, and now I'm going to talk about it.
Go for it.
Yeah. So some patients present with idiopathic diabetes. So they are antibody negative with a low CPEP. So antibody negative, insulin deficient, and then over a period of time, they develop antibodies. Which is a not atypical presentation. But what this means is antibodies are great, but the lack of antibodies does not rule out type 1 diabetes, which I think is a really important distinction to make. The presence of antibodies means you've got type 1 diabetes or you have LADA. The lack of antibodies just means you don't have antibodies. But moving on.
Wouldn't be diabetes if it wasn't confusing.
Oh, so, you know? Confusing.
And you said study bias, and of course I'm never surprised there. You know, with the type 2 we're about to talk about, of course, being the far more prevalent. Unfortunately, it feels like type 1 is not nearly as well studied as maybe it could be.
Yeah, there's
But go
some
ahead.
interesting studying there. So, yeah, let's talk about insulin-resistant diabetes, which is type 2 diabetes. So, where type 1 is an autoimmune disorder, type 2 diabetes is a metabolic disorder characterized by insulin resistance and beta cell dysfunction. So, people with type 2 usually have a relative insulin deficiency rather than an absolute insulin deficiency. So, that is to say, the pancreas is producing a lot of insulin because your body isn't using it efficiently, which means you have higher insulin needs, which is one of the reasons that type 2 diabetic or people with type 2 diabetes will often experience some degree of beta cell burnout and need some insulin to take the load off their pancreas until they've sort of treated the underlying insulin resistance. So there is this perception that everybody with type 2 diabetes is obese, and obesity itself does cause some degree of insulin resistance. But patients who are not obese by traditional weight criteria may just have an increased percentage of body fat distributed predominantly in the abdominal region, which, we've kind of hit on, talked about this in the past a little bit, and this is intra-abdominal fat. So that intra-abdominal fat is closely linked to insulin resistance and is present kind of regardless of what your BMI or your, overall weight is. And you can't target fat loss. So intra-abdominal fat can be incredibly difficult or just impossible to reduce. Another kind of compounding factor with type 2 diabetes is that it frequently goes undiagnosed for many years because, of a gradual development of the hyperglycemia. At early stages, it's often not severe enough for a patient to notice, and they're not, exhibiting any classic symptoms of diabetes.
Yeah, I wonder how many years I'd had it before I was diagnosed, and how much longer I would have gone without being diagnosed if I hadn't got lucky and had a very astute eye doctor take some pictures of the back of my eye and be like, "Hey, that's you need to see somebody." So, insulin resistance, of course, might improve with weight reduction and medication use. But is seldom restored to normal. This is probably the big takeaway for type 2. Reversing type 2 diabetes is not a thing. The underlying condition is going to remain and require management through either lifestyle or pharmaceutical means. Age, obesity, lack of physical activity all increase the risk of developing type 2. Interestingly, type 2 also occurs more frequently in women with prior gestational diabetes. And in individuals with hypertension or dyslipidemia. And some racial ethnic subgroups have a higher incidence. There is a strong genetic predisposition to type 2, although the genetics are complex and not clearly defined. Family history is a useful tool for evaluating relative risk, but just because there's a family history does not mean someone's going to develop type 2. And similarly, just because there's no family history does not mean that someone will not develop it. Much of the complexity around type 2 diabetes lies with the genetic versus lifestyle risk factors. To be clear, again, you will not give yourself type 2 diabetes. It may be possible to trigger onset of it if you have an underlying genetic predisposition and increased risk factors, such as a sedentary lifestyle and obesity. But odds are good that even if you lack the risk factors, if you have a genetic predisposition, you may develop some degree of insulin resistance regardless of lifestyle and weight.
Yeah, so I mean, yeah, you don't do this to yourself. I mean, any type of diabetes, with the exception we're about to hit, right? There's always an exception. But
Of
yeah,
course.
you don't do this to yourself. You can't control things. You can try to mitigate some of your risk factors, control what you can, but at the end of the day, you just got to roll with it. So you know, while type 1 and type 2 diabetes are really the most common types of diabetes, you know, in the general population, these are the ones that everybody knows about. But there are also a bunch of other types of diabetes. So let's talk about those, you know, kind of now. So type 3C diabetes is also known as pancreagenic diabetes or secondary diabetes. And arguably, this is actually the most straightforward atypical form of diabetes, if only because the why do I have diabetes is very clear. So type 3C develops when the pancreas stops producing enough insulin due to an illness or condition that affects or damages the pancreas. So this often occurs if somebody has a surgery that damages or removes part of the pancreas. You damage the pancreas through some illness or a disease or from a surgery, and you impair your insulin secretion. So diabetes. So, you know, common causes of type 3C diabetes, pancreatitis, cystic fibrosis, neoplasia, and any kind of trauma or
pancreatectomy.
Sure, that one.
How about that?
Pancreatectomy. Yes. God, so close. So partial removal of the organ. As kind of an aside, almost 90% of people with pancreatic cancer or chronic pancreatitis develop type 3C. So the diagnostic criteria for type 3C includes poor function of the pancreas, visible damage that can be identified on imaging scans like a CT scan, or a partial or complete removal of the pancreas. Kind of the side note to that is that diagnosis requires ruling out other types of diabetes. So doctors will often look for autoimmune markers that you would see in type 1 diabetes when they are assessing for type 3C.
I just had a thought. I mean, wouldn't the treatment look nearly identical between that and your average type 1?
Absolutely.
At the end of the day?
Yeah. Okay. No, you remove the pancreas, you impair insulin secretion, yeah, and you are managing with insulin. This is not an insulin resistance issue. This is a insulin deficiency issue. Yeah.
Gotcha. So another type of diabetes that falls under the type 3 category, type 3A, type 3B, is called MODY, M-O-D-Y, a.k.a. maturity onset diabetes of the young. MODY is a relatively rare form of diabetes that has some unique management methods associated with it. MODY is associated with a monogenetic defects in B-cell function. These forms of diabetes are frequently characterized by onset of hyperglycemia at an early age, generally before 25 years, and characterized by impaired insulin secretion with minimal or no insulin resistance. MODY is genetic and, as mentioned by Dr. Hirsch in a previous episode, can be identified by 50% of a family having the condition as a result of the dominant gene passed down through the mother. Management of MODY can range from requiring insulin to requiring no medications at all, depending on the type, and combinations of medications that don't work for a type 1 diabetic can work super well in some people with MODY. Interestingly, many types of MODY don't require insulin for the first 10 to 15 years, and one type, known as MODY 2, only requires treatment during pregnancy.
Yeah, MODY is wild. And there's, yeah, there's a bunch of subtypes, and they keep finding more. So, yeah, but it is also pretty uncommon. So, there is that.
Yeah.
So let's kind of sidestep a little bit, and we can talk about the other really well-known type of diabetes, you know, the one that goes along with babies. So gestational diabetes. Gestational diabetes is defined as any degree of glucose intolerance with onset or first recognition during pregnancy. So this definition applies regardless of treatment, whether or not you're using insulin or just modifying your diet, and is also independent of whether or not the diabetes persists after the pregnancy is over. And I cannot believe that I need to say this, but if somebody has a diabetes diagnosis before pregnancy, they do not have gestational diabetes. Your diabetes does not suddenly switch from being type 1 diabetes to gestational diabetes. Gestational diabetes is identified during pregnancy, and it does not exclude the possibility that there may have been some pre-existing insulin resistance that was simply unidentified during screening until the person became pregnant. So typically, gestational diabetes is identified in the second or third trimester, and it's generally screened for at the first prenatal visit, as well as at 24 or 28 weeks of gestation. For patients with a high risk of gestational diabetes, which really that's marked obesity, a history of gestational diabetes, both family or individual, testing often is a little more frequent throughout the pregnancy. And if a high-risk patient is found to not have gestational diabetes during an initial screening, they still get recurring testing for that. As I kind of mentioned, treating gestational diabetes can be highly variable, super individualized. A lot of people are able to successfully manage with diet and exercise. Some people are able to manage with oral medications like metformin, and others have to use insulin injections. Although many patients with gestational diabetes do not go on to develop diabetes later in life, others may be developed or may be diagnosed years later, postpartum, with type 2 or type 1 diabetes, or just some degree of insulin resistance or elevated fasting blood glucose, which would fall under kind of the pre-diabetes category. And it's worth noting that, 6 weeks-ish after a pregnancy ends, patients are generally retested to determine if they still have diabetes or an elevated fasting glucose or insulin resistance, or whether or not they've just returned to a normal glucose regulation. And in the majority of gestational diabetes cases, glucose regulation returns to normal after delivery, like almost instantaneously.
It's amazing. You take all the pressure off of your system and suddenly everything just works like it's supposed to again.
Weird, right? It turns out that growing a human is hard on your body.
Hard work. Yeah. Yeah. Getting back into the less common forms of diabetes, drug-induced diabetes. There are many drugs that can impair insulin secretion. These drugs may not cause diabetes by themselves, but they may precipitate diabetes in individuals that have insulin resistance. In such cases, the classification is unclear because the sequence or relative importance of beta cell dysfunction and insulin resistance is unknown. Certain toxins, such as Vacor, a rat poison, and intravenous pentamidine, can permanently destroy pancreatic beta cells. Such drug reactions, fortunately, are rare. There are also many drugs and hormones that can impair insulin action. Examples improve nicotinic acid and glucocorticoids. Patients receiving alpha and furion have been reported to develop diabetes associated with islet cell antibodies and, in certain instances, severe insulin deficiency.
There are also certain viruses associated with beta cell destruction that cause what is known as illness-induced diabetes. And this diabetes will occur in patients with things like congenital rubella. And while most of these patients have that HLA gene and immune markers that are characteristic of type 1 diabetes, you can also have some other diseases independent of these markers, like cytomegalovirus and adenovirus and mumps. These are all have been implicated in certain cases of inducing diabetes.
You may have heard over the past couple of years that there appears to be some diabetes caused by COVID-19 infection, although the actual mechanism and duration of this is still poorly understood. COVID-19-induced diabetes is an atypical diabetes that may be caused in part by new-onset insulin resistance from COVID infection. In some cases, the COVID virus may damage the beta cells, resulting in insulin deficiency. Several retrospective analysis suggests that the beta cells will heal over time and patients may be able to go off on insulin and manage with insulin resistance meds and ultimately return to normal glucose regulation. Insulin resistance in COVID patients appears to be independent of pre-existing risk factors. Other patients presenting with atypical diabetes, somewhere between type 1 and type 2, with the COVID virus triggering islet cell autoimmunity in genetically susceptible individuals. SARS-CoV-2, the COVID infection of the pancreatic beta cells causes them to transdifferentiate, which can lead to lower insulin expression and higher glucagon and trypsin 1 production, which helps explain the dysregulation of glucose homeostasis seen in COVID-19 patients, which could potentially trigger new onset diabetes.
So yeah, that's a lot of stuff.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. And yeah. It's super confusing. And the takeaway really should be that COVID-induced diabetes is still really new and still being studied. At this point, there are some general ideas. There's been a couple large-scale metadata analyses that suggest that there is a significantly increased risk of developing diabetes after contracting COVID. But there's also some question as to if COVID is triggering faster development of type 2 diabetes in people who were already undiagnosed, if people were undiagnosed pre-diabetic or undiagnosed type 2 diabetes. It's also unclear if some of this increased diagnostic numbers of new diabetes is simply because people are being screened. So there is this, if you test people more, you may just be identifying more cases and identifying them earlier. Hard to tell. There does seem to be some pretty clear-cut atypical presentations of diabetes being triggered by COVID. Stay tuned.
And with as hard as COVID appears to affect certain individuals and their systems, it doesn't feel surprising, but looking forward to more information and more studies being done there.
It's going to be.
Maybe we'll have an episode in a couple years where we get to talk about everything they learned.
It's certainly on the wish list. We've started researching a COVID specific episode and just the body of knowledge just isn't there yet. It's so confusing. And there's a lot of conflicting information. It's going to be a few years before we've got anything that we really can speak intelligently about without throwing in all of the disclaimers.
Yeah, for sure. So we've made it through all of the, I'm going to use air quote, official actual diabetes diagnosis, but we couldn't do a types episode without talking about pre-diabetes, which we see a lot of in our support spaces as well. Pre-diabetes refers to an intermediate metabolic stage with impaired glucose tolerance and or impaired fasting glucose. The terms IGT and IFG refer to a metabolic stage intermediate between normal glucose homeostasis and diabetes, which is known as pre-diabetes. Essentially, you are on the way to being diabetic and we're seeing it on tests. This stage includes individuals who have impaired glucose tolerance and individuals with fasting glucose levels greater than 110 mg/dL, that's 6.1 millimoles, but still less than 126 mg/dL, a 7.0 millimole. Impaired fasting glucose refers to a fasting plasma glucose level greater than 110 mg/dL, 6.1 millimole, but less than 140 mg/dL, which is 7.8 millimole. A fasting glucose of 109 mg/dL, 6.1 millimole, is considered non-diabetic, aka normal, and that is a big air quote around the word normal. Although it is recognized that this choice is somewhat arbitrary, it is near the level above which acute phase insulin secretion is lost in response to intravenous administration of glucose, and is associated with progressively greater risk of developing micro and macro vascular complications. In the absence of pregnancy, IFG and IGT are not clinical entities in their own right, but rather risk factors for future diabetes and cardiovascular disease. All that to say, just because you have prediabetes, that does not mean you're going to develop type 2. But as we've talked about before, if you have prediabetes, a lot of the things that you would do to manage type 2 are also very effective. Diet, lifestyle choices, certain insulin resistance medications, etc.
Yeah. The prediabetes diagnosis, like the umbrella, even just calling it prediabetes, there's a lot of doctors who think it's absolute BS because you manage it. Like, it's okay, it's insulin resistance light. But if you have to actively manage it, then, you know, calling it prediabetes is kind of a misnomer. And I very much enjoy listening to doctors bitch about the prediabetes label. Because I absolutely agree. It's a stupid label.
I've been type 2 for over a decade, and every time somebody pre-diabetic comes into a support space, it's the same thing. Like, you know, because then the internet leads them to believe they can, air quote, reverse, you know, pre-diabetes. And again, if you are predisposed to these things, you can manage them, but you're never going to reverse them.
Yeah.
And here's some ideas for you.
Yeah, you can't fix the underlying metabolic condition. And there are a lot of people who have this, you know, quote-unquote pre-diabetes metabolic condition. So, okay, a slightly impaired glucose tolerance, who go their entire life with just a slightly impaired glucose tolerance, and it doesn't get worse, but it's not going to get better without, you know, active intervention. And lifestyle changes are active intervention. So getting off that soapbox.
Yes.
We're going to step onto my other soapbox, which is this, you know, occasionally heard and super confusing and misleading type 3 diabetes, which is not what you think it is. So type 3 is not an officially recognized diagnosis. It is a term that has been proposed to describe the link between type 1 and type 2 diabetes and Alzheimer's. So type 3 umbrella is used by some medical professionals, not the industry at large, to refer to Alzheimer's or dementia-related diabetes. It's a super confusing and misappropriated term. You also hear it used by some people to describe themselves as diabetes supporters. Oh, I'm a type 3. I have type 3 diabetes because I am supporting my, you know, family member with diabetes. All right, it's fine. Whatever. It's not a great label. It's confusing. Type 3 diabetes actually is a broad category of real clinical diabetes diagnoses, you know, that makes up that MODY and that, you know, pancreogenetic diabetes. So don't use type 3 diabetes to describe yourself if you don't have diabetes.
Yes, please. Thank you. Before Amy loses her mind on you.
Yeah, I'm pulling my hair out. So the dementia-related type 3 diabetes occurs when neurons in the brain become unable to respond to insulin, which obviously is essential for basic tasks, including memory and learning. So some researchers believe that insulin deficiency is central to the cognitive decline of Alzheimer's patients, which in turn is linked to the variant of the Alzheimer's gene known as APOE4. So a Mayo Clinic research team actually found that this APOE4 gene, which is present in around 20% of the general population and is also present in more than half of Alzheimer's cases, is responsible for interrupting how the brain processes insulin. Some mice with this APOE4 gene showed insulin impairment, particularly in old age. And studies have also found that a high-fat diet could accelerate this process in middle-aged mice with this gene. So in short, there is a gene and peripheral insulin resistance caused by a high-fat diet that induced insulin resistance in the brain. So, you know, these levels of insulin and insulin receptor and insulin signaling are lower in Alzheimer patients' brains, and epidemiological studies have confirmed that diabetic patients are at a higher risk of developing Alzheimer's. To summarize this super, super oversimplifying it, you know, this APOE4 protein begins to clump, it becomes toxic, and begins to impede receptors from accessing neuron surfaces to work. This increasingly impairs insulin signaling and starves your brain cells. So it's a whole lot of science talk. It's outside of our normal topics, and we're going to not elaborate on this. I've dropped some links in the show notes. TLDR, if somebody's going to talk about dementia-related or Alzheimer's-related diabetes, type 3, all right, fine, I guess. The type 3 umbrella is more of the atypical diabetes presentations rather than anything else.
So that was a lot. At this point, I think we have dropped more knowledge about the different types of diabetes than I think our listeners may have ever wanted. Hopefully they did, if they're listening to us. But if we, you know, we hope it was educational. Hope you can take this knowledge and go forth and educate the masses, educate your maybe less than knowledgeable family member, usually an extended family member who means well but doesn't know anything. Don't ask me why that seems so relevant. But yeah, this kind of information and having real information is super helpful for going out there to dispel stereotypes and really educate people about the condition known as diabetes. So, Amy, any final words for our listeners this month?
Not really. You know, I will say that we kind of bumped this episode up in our order of episode notes planned episodes, you know, because one of our listeners reached out and asked if we had one, you know, an episode on types in the works. If you have a suggestion for an episode, let us know. We are flexible, and it's almost easier for us to plan ahead based on what people want to listen to. So
absolutely. We've got quite a few episode ideas, but we're always open to our fans' feedback. So check those socials in our show notes. Thank you all again for listening to us again this month. Thank you, Amy, for joining me again. And take care. We'll talk to you again next month. Living with diabetes is exhausting, both for our bodies and minds. It's not surprising that many diabetics struggle with the mental health sides of this disease, including burnout and diabetes distress. We at the DiaCast want to remind anyone who is struggling that you deserve all the help and support in the world. If you're struggling, please go to diacast.com/resources for a list of resources and links, diabetes support groups, ways to find therapists in your area who specialize in diabetes, and crisis lines. Diabetes is hard, and sometimes we all need a hand.